right, this is WNHN LP 94.7 in Concord, and you are listening to State House Watch. I'm Arnie Alpert.
I'm Maggie Fogarty, and we come to you from the American Friends Service Committee's New Hampshire program every week at this hour, live at 5 p.m. on Mondays, rebroadcast on Tuesday mornings at 8 a.m., bringing you the goings-on at the New Hampshire State House.
Great. And this is also the audio version, in a sense, of our weekly State House Watch newsletter, which comes out every Friday, and you can subscribe to that for free by going to our website at afsc.org/NH. Just look for the State House Watch subscribe button and do what it says. Push the button and fill it in.
That's right. And we put that newsletter out every Friday between January and the end of June during the state legislative session.
This is season 10 for the State House Watch newsletter and season 8 for the State House Watch radio show.
And we can do this show because of our great support from WNHN-FM, our partner in community radio here in Concord.
And especially our engineer, producer, volunteer, coordinator,
everything.
Fred Portnoy.
Fixer.
That's all right. Anyway, so thanks for listening. And we are going to talk a little bit today about the state of the state, because that was the topic of an address by Governor Sununu last Thursday. You were there in the hallway, weren't you?
I was in the hallway. We were going to be there the prior week. Folks may remember that snow changed our plans. But we, Voices of Faith and others, joined a large showing by state employees who wanted to make sure that as the governor traveled into the House chamber for his State of the State address, that he would be reminded very clearly that he has significant work to do to treat our state employees fairly and negotiate fairly for their contract.
Now, there were a lot of their members were actually having a rally outside the State House, weren't they, in
That's
the morning?
That's right, yeah.
But did they then go in? Did everybody
go
inside?
Yes, they were outside, quite visible.
Okay. All
there
right.
For some time. They were marching around the State House.
Right. And then the governor comes in the back door, so I was just concerned that if they were all out front, he might not have seen
miss
them.
Yeah, I think they were there for themselves at
all
the
right,
beginning,
all right.
Just, you know, kind of lifting each other up. This whole contract stalemate is demoralizing. I was speaking to some of the state employees, and they really do experience it as disrespect for them, for their well-being, their livelihoods, and all of their concerns. But no, by the time the governor needed to make his way through the Senate chamber, through that back way into the House chamber, he had many folks waiting to send him a message.
All right. Well, good.
So,
all right.
Yeah.
So the other thing, of course, now the governor's perspective, the state of the state, is basically very rosy. He wasn't as confrontational, I thought, as he might be. He was trying to strike a kind of bipartisan note. And, I mean, I think he did reasonably well at that. But
that his actions belie a bipartisan spirit.
Yeah,
right?
So that's one of the things. I mean, it is an election. It just seems like it's very difficult right now to watch the State House without thinking about the fact that it's an election year.
Right.
With however many vetoes it was, 56 vetoes.
58 was 58 the net metering one
last year. So 57 last year, one already this year. A lot of those same proposals coming back up again this year, which means they're likely to be headed for the same fate.
A number of them received bipartisan support, too, as they made their way through.
But last year they were bipartisan. This year they're bipartisan. But on an issue like redistricting, which perhaps we'll talk about later on in this show with Olivia Zink from Open Democracy, it doesn't look like the governor's perspective is actually responding to what is authentic bipartisan legislation.
That's right. That's right.
So,
and the Kent Street Coalition has an effective visual display for what seems to be really a very partisan posture that the governor has exhibited toward the work of the legislature, and that's the 58 headstones representing 58 vetoes. Now, we're not tracking or prioritizing all of those bills, but it's still a point that the duly elected legislature has done their work, both bodies, and he has rejected
Right, so there's definitely a conflict of, we talk about balance of power between the legislative branch and the governor, just like we see that in Washington. So that certainly is part of it, but clearly they are at odds with each other. And I don't see much evidence that that's going to change before the end of the year and before the election.
Yeah.
So while the governor says the state of the state is basically pretty rosy, the state of politics is still pretty chilly, I think, over there.
Yeah.
And
Divided.
There's a lot of things going on in the state that don't live up to this rosy image, that while the rate of unemployment is, in fact, very low, that we're still in a situation in which people might need multiple jobs
right.
in order to be able to get by and pay their rent.
People might, in fact, be overemployed because you cannot make ends meet on so many of the jobs that people have. So.
Yeah. There was
we have to tell a fuller story.
We made reference in our newsletter to a recent survey done by Stay Work Play, which is this nonprofit group which was created to try to, you know, there's this story or idea that somehow New Hampshire is bleeding our youth,
mm-hmm.
that people graduate from high school or graduate from college and then they get out of New Hampshire and right. go somewhere else. So what could be done to get people to stick around or to move here who are young adults to make their homes in New Hampshire.
Right.
And they surveyed people and they found that the top issue of concern to young adults in their group was the lack of affordable housing.
Right.
And that was true in every different geographic right. area, and it's certainly something we've discussed on this radio show before.
That's right. And certainly whatever pain that middle class and young professionals are feeling is felt even more acutely yeah. by poor and working class families. So.
And then we also see this great divide between the southern part of the state, which is really part of the Massachusetts economy, and the northern part of the state, which just have very, very different economic realities. Now, we'll talk about those a little bit more perhaps with Anne-Marie French later on in the show. She's the executive director of the New Hampshire Fiscal Policy Institute. They're having their annual conference in Concord this coming Friday, and they've got some research which is very current on these issues that have to do with wages, that have to do with inequality, that have to do with housing, and that also have to do with this north-south divide that we have in the state.
Very
so
good.
Stay tuned, and a little while later you'll get to hear from Anne-Marie French
yeah.
and learn
very
about
worthwhile.
Their,
we yeah. rely on their reports. Certainly, too, in a state budget
yeah.
year, we find their analysis
right,
very helpful.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Now, Maggie, the hearing that I spent a lot of time looking at last week was a bill that's called House Bill 1493, and it's a bill that calls on the state to look at the impact of deportation on families in New Hampshire, specifically or explicitly on U.S. citizens in New Hampshire, is
yes.
the way the bill was written by Representative Nicole Klein Knight from Manchester.
And this bill had a hearing in front of the State Federal Relations Committee.
From the State Federal Relations and Veterans Affairs Committee, for some reason, that's where it went. And they were trying to, at one point, seemed to be a little bit baffled about why they were the committee that was hearing this. Now, of course, none of the people who were there to speak were the right ones to get that.
Had assigned the bill to
question.
That committee.
And then yeah. another question that all the people who spoke, or many people spoke, was that because immigration is a federal matter, why does the state, you know, what might even be the state's ability to do something about it, which is, I think, was a good question.
And I think let's explore
yeah.
that. because there are states
yeah.
that have taken actions to keep their residents safer mm-hmm. or attempt to from this kind of aggressive enforcement.
Right. So, I mean, but I think the people said, you know, if we don't know what the effect is of deportation on people, but maybe we can study this and then maybe we can come up with some things.
Yeah.
Now, the thing that was most interesting about this hearing was that after Representative Klein Knight spoke as the prime sponsor of the bill, the next person who came up to speak was Andres Mata, and I was able to record what he had to say. So I'd like you to...
And he's a Manchester resident?
Yeah, and we'll let Andres introduce himself
Good.
Here. All right.
Good morning. My name is Andres Mata. I live in Manchester, New Hampshire. I'm 13 years old, and I'm currently in 7th grade. And I'm here to testify on behalf of my father, who was deported on May 8th, 2018, because he was misinformed of his paperwork to let him stay in the country. My family had a critical hit from him getting deported. He was an incredible man. He was the fundamental part of my family. He was a very hardworking person. He would come home every day from work, tired, couldn't move his body at all. He helped our family so much financially. For my family, that was a very emotional month for us. My little sister and I would go on walks occasionally with my dad and would occasionally take us shopping for good behavior, good grades. He was a very happy person. For me personally, it felt like the sun got taken away from me. I'm not the only person affected by this. ICE, or Immigration and Customs Enforcement, removed over 267,000 people from their homes and families. My mother, who is very sick, was scared and lost from my dad's deportation. My dad left everything behind. Family, friends, everything. So just consider that many people are losing their parents, their future, and everything. Thank you.
What a heartbreaking story, but bravely told. Yeah. His voice is really powerful.
Yeah.
My.
So it was good. And he and his younger sister, Leslie, sat there for the whole hearing and listened to the other people to speak and listened to the questions that came from committee members, which I think had to also have been hard for them to talk about this reality, not just their family faces, but others. But we also had, we had social workers, we had English as a second language teachers. We had lawyers who got up and told additional stories about the impact of on families like the family of Andres and Leslie.
Very
of
good.
This deportation machine.
Because this painful reality is largely unseen by many folks, if it isn't a direct concern. Just kind of even the poverty that we were discussing earlier with folks having to have three jobs or living in kind of a persistent economic insecurity. It may not be visible to the eye, but people are suffering in a variety of different ways.
Yeah, and as Andres himself says, that his mom's health is not good, and she's left as the main breadwinner of a family with two middle school age children.
Right.
And it's
they just want to be together as a family.
And his dad is in Mexico, you know, and not able to earn much money there.
Yeah.
So it's a rough situation, and we hear it over and over and over again.
Yeah.
So I'm glad that there was an opportunity for Andres and Leslie to meet the members of this committee. I think in general they were well received. I think the story was well received, and we'll need to continue on that. And if this bill does go through the legislative chamber in a positive way through the House, we'll have another chance with the Senate.
Very good. And just thinking about Andres' path, you know, I hope he continues to raise his voice and to see the impact of his story for the greater good.
Yeah, Andres and Leslie had never been at the State House before, so I got to give him a little tour around and stuff, so that was kind of fun also.
Very good. So, well, thank you for doing that.
Yeah.
So, yes, we'll regroup and be prepared for the Senate. We do hope the full House will pass that. Mm-hmm. The full committee has not yet taken action.
No. They have a date next week. Well, next week, actually, the House and Senate are on vacation, and the week after that, they have a scheduled date to what they call exec on this bill.
Okay. So we'll be there listening in.
Hopefully somebody will be able to be there. Now, Maggie, you'll remember that a couple of weeks ago we had Lila Corman from 350 here.
Yes.
And she talked about the no coal, no gas demonstration, which had happened at Merrimack Station in Bow back in September when about 60 people were arrested trying to physically remove the coal from the power plant to keep it from being burned and contributing to global warming.
Such an exciting action to see.
Since between then and now, all of those people went and had arraignments at district court. And on Friday, there was what they called a trial management conference that was there in the court. And I was able to go over there for that. We don't have time right now to get into that in depth, but just to say that after the trial management conference, which set a date for the end of March for everybody to come back again and make additional plans for what will happen if or when they eventually go to trial.
As a group,
there's some different options actually.
Okay.
Some people I believe might accept a finding of guilty and appeal to Superior Court and ask for a jury trial. Some people might want to get a bench trial at district court. So a number of different options are possible and different types of defense might be possible. And then meanwhile, negotiations.
And different ways of advancing the message, it sounds like.
That's right. I mean, that's what they are committed to is continuing to figure out how to advance the message and advance the strategy of shutting down Merrimack Station. So, and then meanwhile, 18 of them who had gone on to be involved in blockades of trains that were delivering coal to Merrimack Station and were arrested in other demonstrations. They were actually went down to the Bow police station where they were all given additional warrants for their arrest for violations of the conditions of their bail. Then they were all released on their own recognizance. So now they've got additional hearings on that.
Okay.
That was thought to be a violation of good behavior. They believe that the good behavior is to shut down Merrimack Station.
Oh,
in any case, I talked to some people out in the parking lot before this hearing started. So let's hear a little bit of this.
Say, that's just not my problem. Some people do what must be done. They see the hole in the fabric that must be sewn. They see the wave arcading it and they roll back the stones. They see the day beyond the horizon. They do.
I live in Brattleboro, Vermont, I'm here today because of a nonviolent direct action I was part of back in September in Bow. We are building unity and power. We are shifting our own relationship to risk and showing people what's possible and hoping to close the Merrimack facility. My understanding is that today we find out what comes next in terms of a potential trial. I hope that we are let off and that it is looked at that we are doing what must be done and that we are doing what is in everyone's best interests, not just our own, but all people, all life on Earth. Fossil fuels, a planet where our children have a right to breathable air and drinkable water and healthy soil and planet.
Do what must be done. Do what must be done. We see the day beyond the horizon. We do what must be done.
You're listening to the Open Democracy Minute, keeping Granite State government by and for the people. Finally, the Democratic candidates talked democracy reform when they debated in Manchester on February 7th. Senator Elizabeth Warren talked about public financing of elections, which reform groups around the country have been advocating as the most important reform to neutralize the power of the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision. Positions on how the candidates have raised money for the campaign was a hotly debated issue as well, pitting candidates using conventional large donor sources against others using small donors. It's easy for candidates to say they'll work to overturn Citizens United, but it may be years before enough states have called for action, and even longer for Congress to formally propose the amendment. The more immediate task for a prospective president is using political capital to move H.R. 1, the omnibus democracy reform bill passed by the U.S. House of Representatives in February 2019, to a vote in the U.S. Senate. H.R. 1 tries to fix gerrymandering with independent redistricting commissions, establishes a public financing of elections system with 6-to-1 match, reforms the Federal Elections Commission, and has several other important reforms. It will go a long way to giving power back to the voters. Presidential candidates, as you leave New Hampshire, remember what you said at the debate and at our Open Democracy and Equal Citizens to Democracy town halls. We'll be watching. As Granny D said, if money is speech, then speech ain't free. For the Open Democracy Minute, I'm Brian Beal.
All right, Brian Beal from Open Democracy with their Democracy Minute. So welcome back to State House Watch Radio. You're with Maggie Fogarty.
And Arnie Alpert.
And in the studio with us today is Olivia Zink, Director of Open Democracy. Welcome, Olivia.
It's a pleasure to be with you tonight.
And you've been here a couple of times with us, but why don't you just remind folks of who you are and where you're from and what you do.
So my name is Olivia Zink, and I'm the Executive Director at Open Democracy. And our organization was founded by Granny D, who walked across the country. And in 2 weeks marks 20 years since Doris reached Washington, D.C. on her 3,200-mile walk across the country. Wow. For campaign finance reform. And so we work on sort of what I call the structure of our democracy, campaign finance, voting rights, and redistricting reform.
Issues as urgently important as they have ever been.
Now, Olivia, you were very active during the long New Hampshire primary campaign, and one of the main things you did was you tried to entice all the major candidates to come to events you call Democracy Town Hall. So tell us about that and about how that went, how many people came, and do you feel you were successful in getting those issues injected into the presidential campaign debate?
You know, something I learned from Arnie Alpert many years ago is how, you know, we need to use our voice in the New Hampshire primary to lift up the issues that we care about. But not just going to different town halls and asking questions, but this cycle we hosted our own town hall series with 16 other organizations. And we were able to have 11 democracy town halls with 11 different presidential candidates, including Bill Weld on the Republican side. And they were very successful. I think we had over 500 people at our biggest town hall to discuss the issues of money and politics, voting rights, and redistricting reform. And it was really important that we carved out an hour of their schedule to talk about these systematic reforms that are needed.
In a focused way. And in general, how did they do? Do you feel like the candidates in this primary season are sharp and well-versed and understand what's at stake here and what needs to be done?
I do. I think that due to the citizens that are participated with Open Democracy and others, we really push them to not only have robust democracy plans, but solutions and really of the candidates that had democracy town halls, they really spoke to the need for those solutions.
And what kinds of solutions would they be able to implement?
So public financing of elections to mm-hmm. change the way our elections are funded. Many of them have to have different plans on how to do that, including what I think is the most important idea, a solution that would give everybody democracy dollars, as Andrew Yang calls it, vouchers, as Bernie Sanders talked about it, but also Deval Patrick talked about these plans. Right now, money is flowing into our elections from big corporations. And what we're trying to do is say, okay, we know that it costs money for elections, but we want them to be funded by people. Mm-hmm. And there's many Americans that can't give $10 or $5 to a candidate. But if they get four $25 certificates or, you know, whatever they get to give to candidates of their choice, we can make all voters empowered to participate in a different way.
Wow. Do you have models of that in some of the states already?
So South Dakota passed a model with this, but it wasn't implemented yet. The city of Seattle has successfully implemented this. And Seattle actually is a very interesting story about how city council races were funded by developers. There was no affordable housing in the city, and they changed the way elections were funded. And housing advocates were able to run for city council the first election, going and getting tenants to organize tenants to be donors to their council race and win races in the city of Seattle. And then the last election, Amazon tried to do an independent expenditure and really drowned out the voices of everyday citizens of Seattle, and it didn't work. Mm. The democracy dollars came through in a big way to say, no, we want candidates that represent our values, that are accountable to people, and the big independent ads ran by Amazon didn't work.
Oh, that's exciting. Yeah. And then I assume is redistricting guidelines a part of the federal roadmap as well?
Yeah. And I think this week marks a year from when H.R. 1, the biggest democracy reform, most robust democracy reform package, passed. And in that is redistricting reform.
Did that pass the House?
It passed the House. It didn't pass the Senate. It's sitting on Mitch McConnell's desk waiting to...
With a whole bunch of other stuff. Yeah.
So, but doesn't redistricting happen at the state level? So what's the federal role on redistricting?
So there's two different there's a couple of different ways where the federal government can play a role in redistricting. One is mandating independent commissions to happen at the state level, and also to set criteria of what redistricting looks like. So there has been some efforts of reforming redistricting at the state level, but also there's a role for federal level to set guidelines on what congressional districts look like.
And a standard.
Yeah. Olivia Zink, while it does seem like a lot of candidates, I mean, remember like Kristen Gillibrand, who we've already forgotten about practically. Mm-hmm. I mean, she was there, she came, she went. But she was like really strong in talking about this stuff. It was like the pillar of her campaign to talk about democracy reform and getting money out of politics. She did that very effectively. I think that in general, the issues have come up really well. But meanwhile, we've got a billionaire in the White House. We've got Tom Steyer making a strong run as a self-financed billionaire. And now we've got Michael Bloomberg.
Maybe a mega billionaire.
coming along. And he's already spent more money than I guess all the other Democratic candidates combined on his campaign without anybody even voting for him yet, in effect. He hasn't even been on a ballot yet. So how are you sizing up where this issue of money in our political system is going? Are we going forward or backwards?
I think anyone you talk to, whether they're on the left or the right, they're disgusted by how much money is involved in our political process. All the super PACs running ads, negative ads. Their phones were ringing off the hook. They got mail. Their inboxes were full. And I think when we think about should there be a path for citizens to run for president that doesn't include being a billionaire. I think there should be a path for us to elect leaders that don't have – aren't self-made billionaires. Mm.
Do you think – maybe we don't want to go too far in predicting, but I'm just thinking about this whole Michael Bloomberg phenomenon right now and wondering whether we're going to see people recoiling against him because of this.
Because of the stink of this,
Or whether people will just be, okay, well, this is – they're getting messages. He's hiring plenty of campaign workers and people will be hearing from him. Mm-hmm.
But you look at the election where Trump said that he doesn't have to take money from people. So he
So he's less corrupt because of that.
He's less corrupt because of that. Yeah. And people bought into that narrative. Yeah. So it's hard to know what the pulse of the voters will be in November. But I think it's really important to say, what do we want to build? We want to build a government that represents all of the voices of everyday people and not just those who can buy and access power.
Mm. Yeah. Amen.
All right.
Can you talk a little bit about how we did in New Hampshire in terms of voting? Did it go smoothly? How was turnout?
And registration.
How registration went?
New voters.
Well, I just happened to pull down the numbers from the Secretary of State's office, and there were over 300,000 Democratic voters and 156 Republican ballots that were cast on Tuesday.
156,000.
156,000. 157,106 people came to the polls and cast their ballots. It seemed like, there was not terrifically long lines in places. There wasn't a lot of reported problems mm-hmm. of people being able to register. And New Hampshire is unique that we have same-day registration.
Right.
New Hampshire is unique in that if you are registered undeclared, we have an open primary, so you can pick a ballot and pick a party to vote for. Mm-hmm. I sat in my polling place all day, and there are a few people who are registered at a party who wanted to switch that same day who weren't able to. And so there's always some mishaps or somebody who shows up at the wrong polling place and needs to go to the right polling place. But I think overall, the elections ran smoothly and turnout was high.
Okay, can you just characterize high, like these numbers compared to, say, 2016 primary, 2008 primary?
As far as total ballots cast, mm-hmm. we were less than what was cast 4 years ago. But 4 years ago, remember, there was an open Democratic primary and open Republican primary, so the races were more contended on both sides. This time we have an incumbent president running for reelection, so the number of Republican ballots cast were lower.
Much lower, yes. Yeah.
Olivia, we've had a lot of controversy about the whole issue of registration and whether you need to be a resident or be domiciled, and that led to some confusion about whether college students could or should be able to vote if they're from out of state but they're living in New Hampshire while they're going to college. Did you hear about any problems with regard to people registering to vote based on this issue of residency?
I didn't, but I haven't called the AG's office to see if there was complaints filed. I haven't spoken to the college town clerks to see what they experienced last week. So to answer your question fully, we don't really know what the impact of these laws are. But I really hope that people understood that they still had a constitutional right to vote.
And I saw some very cheering messages from the New Hampshire Youth Movement that spent a lot of time and energy on campuses trying to get voters who were already registered, get new voters to the polls. And they were celebrating some significant increases in numbers from previous years.
So. Well, I guess perhaps the question will be whether, because we do have this law, it's being challenged in court, but there is this law that says that if you say that you are a resident of New Hampshire and register to vote, that at some point you can then be required to get a New Hampshire driver license, and if you own a car, register a car here. Mm-hmm. But it's unclear. The Secretary of State says, well, that's not their job to enforce that law, and it's not clear whose job it would be to try to make a connection between new registrants and whether how people's cars are registered.
You'd think that would just happen incidentally with encounters with local PD
so
or something.
Hard to know. So we'll have to keep
it. Yeah, but I don't know that local PD has the voter roll. So
no, but they might say, do you – well, good point. So, yeah, so good luck trying to make those connections.
It's hard to try to figure that out. And then meanwhile, that case is still going forward in the court as well as another challenge to a different law which changed the way in which late registrants are treated in terms of verifying that they are who they are and live where they live. And those cases are both going forward in court. Open Democracy is not a party to either of those, but you're part of the voting coalition.
Yes. So one of those cases is brought forth by the League of Women Voters that around the domicile rules and what you need to do to prove who you are and where you live, and even citizenship for that matter, that you were born here and that you're a citizen. And it changes those affidavits that you have to sign. And then the second case, as Arnie mentioned, is really targeted towards young folks. But, you know, I think about residents in a nursing home. That may have moved to a nursing home that might not have their car registered or their driver's license.
Transferred over
to those.
Yeah. One of the bills we've been following is a bill called HB 1700, which has to do with people who have been accepted as applicants for political asylum in the United States. So they're lawfully present, and under current rules with the Department of Motor Vehicles, they would be able to get a driver's license after they get a work permit, which typically takes about 6 months. So what this bill would do is say that once your application for asylum has been accepted, you can go down and apply for a driver's license, take the driver's test, and if you pass
it, which is really significant.
Totally makes sense.
A lot of sense.
But what turns out is that some of the legislators are confused about this because they're saying, oh, no, if people get a driver's license, then they're going to be able to vote and vote fraudulently. But I'm not seeing any stories, Maggie, about people who are not U.S. citizens showing up at the polling places and trying to claim that they have a right to vote.
Right. And what those comments reveal is that people don't understand. There are all sorts of folks with valid New Hampshire driver licenses who aren't eligible voters. So
they're not trying to vote.
And they're not trying to because the stakes are extremely high.
Yeah.
I don't know a single person who thinks that they're – not that we don't think individual votes matter. That's not the message here. But I don't know a single person who thinks that their single ballot in an election is worth not only losing their immigration pathway but being charged with a felony. So
anyway, so that's another just so where some of these issues of immigration and voting kind of cross over. Of course, I guess President Trump, again, on the his election eve rally in Manchester was again talking about, you know, the busloads of illegal voters.
With Governor Sununu in the audience, and he didn't seem willing to push back hard against that the next day.
That was just absolutely not true. That did not happen.
Right.
And when you register to vote, you have to prove that you are a citizen and that you are – you do live here, and you have to swear under oath and sign those forms.
Right.
It's a serious thing, and I think people who come to the polls to vote take that seriously.
Very seriously.
Right, good. Yeah. Olivia, we don't have time to get into your whole state house agenda, but maybe a quick word about where we are with redistricting right now in New Hampshire.
Great. Thank you, Arnie. And there's been an effort to change the way we do redistricting in the state. So in previous years, the party in charge behind closed doors will draw up the maps. And this year, there's been an effort to create a independent redistricting commission of 5 Republicans, 5 Democrats, and 5 undeclared voters. And those 15 people would come together, hold public hearing, and have a criteria in which they draw the maps, including not using partisan data to draw the voting maps. And
so like criteria like regional coherence or economic –
communities of interest is the term they use.
Great.
To lay out a criteria that's fair and equitable and that has to agree – you have to get Republicans, Democrats, and independents to agree that these are the ways. And we shouldn't allow politicians to be picking our voters. Voters should feel like they pick politicians by casting their ballots. And so there's a work session tomorrow on that new
tomorrow
effort.
Tomorrow being Tuesday.
Tomorrow being Tuesday.
In what committee?
election law.
In the House. Right. So we will, sense. Olivia Zink, we will have you back again later in this season to talk about where we've gone with redistricting reform, with lobbying reform, with money in politics here in New Hampshire. Thanks for being with us.
And thanks, Maggie, for all your great work.
One of the other things that Open Democracy has done this season, Maggie, is they have put out in the streets the corruption choir. So here is here's a little music for us.
Interest, super PAC cash, buying all the airwaves. On the air, there's a gob of big money. Interest laughing, bills are passing, making CEOs smile. On the K Street corners, you'll hear. Bought in souls, it's influence time in the country. Ding-a-ling, ching-ching-ching, soon it will be election day. Lines of donors asking favors for a pile of big green as the voters beg leaders to listen. Hear the greenbacks drown the public, said United's big deed, and from all of the voters you'll hear. Bought in soul, it's influence time in the country. Ding-a-ling, ching-ching-ching, soon it will be election day.
All right, that was the Open Democracy Corruption Choir recorded yesterday at a reception in Concord. So
it's just great.
Isn't that fun? Yeah. Anyway, this is State House Watch. I'm Arnie Alpert.
I'm Maggie Fogarty.
And we are in the studio with Anne-Marie French, who is the executive director of the New Hampshire Fiscal Policy Institute. Anne-Marie, we've had your colleagues on the show plenty of times, but I'm not sure we've ever had you in the studio with us, have we?
This is my very first time. Hey, my inaugural.
Even from Pleasant Street, we didn't have you up on the second floor.
Right. Well, very good. Well, anyway, well, welcome.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Tell us a little bit about how you got to New Hampshire Fiscal Policy Institute and what the Fiscal Policy Institute is. And again, for our listeners, the reason that we especially want Anne-Marie to come in today is because you've got your annual event. Your seventh annual conference is coming up this Friday in Concord, and we would love to hear a little bit about that. So welcome, Anne-Marie. Tell us about what we need to hear.
Thank you. Well, so your first question, you asked how I came to the Fiscal Policy Institute. Yeah. I've been there since early 2014, so it's been quite a while. I started as the communications manager. And
I remember that.
I really just absolutely love the mission and role and work of this organization and get to work with, you know, great people in the state trying to improve public policy. So, so a little bit about what we do. So we focus on the state budget, how we fund public services in the state, the revenue system, and the economy with a lens of low and moderate income people. So, and this is our seventh annual conference coming up this Friday. Our theme this year is Strengthening New Hampshire, Creating Equitable Opportunities for All Granite Staters, and really focusing in on how, you know, so there's a great top line story that the state economy is doing very well by some measures, but many people aren't feeling that same. The economy hasn't lifted everybody equally. And so we're really going to dive in to the data, you know, where are Granite Staters now in terms of demographics, income, wages, and looking at specifically, we have a panel discussion that's going to sort of focus on those three foundational areas: health, housing, and education, and really look at, you know, does everyone have access to the same opportunities, which we know that they don't, whether it's based on cost or where you live in the state. The different regions have different access to different opportunities. And we've got a panel discussion that's going to focus on that, enhancing equitable access to housing, health, and education. We'll have Ben Frost of New Hampshire Housing Finance Authority, Ann Landry, she's Associate Commissioner of Population Health for the New Hampshire Department of Health and Human Services, and Michael Termel, he's the Director Director of Education and Career Initiatives for the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation, but has 20 years of experience working in New Hampshire public schools, starting as a teacher, working as a principal, working on his way up to assistant superintendent. And he really has some incredible insight into the disparities that he observed with children working in his 20 years in education. Now he's bringing that all together at the Charitable Foundation, focusing on how to advance equitable opportunities, actually, in education. So,
excellent.
Really exciting panel. It's going to be moderated by one of NHFBI's board members, Victoria Adewumi. She's really exceptional. She works at the Manchester Health Department as a community liaison and really has great insight as well into the connection of all three of these areas, but also the equity piece for different populations, particularly working in Manchester. We're going to talk about that, too.
Very good.
In the course of the event. And then the second half of the event, we're going to dive into some sort of local community level data. We've got three presentations. Our own Phil Sletten is going to give some insight into local economic conditions and community challenges. And then we have Evelyn Asa from Reaching Higher New Hampshire. She's going to give a brief overview of their recent report, The Whole Picture of Public Education in New Hampshire, which really has some startling data in there. And then a third community-based presentation, Katie Easterly Marte from the Community Development Finance Authority is going to share some details of a data project that we actually worked with them in collaboration to produce their new data index. So really all of this is about, you know, how can we better understand the conditions in communities and how can we work together to help lift everyone up? That's really the goal.
Excellent. And a shared understanding and a deeper analysis a really important building block for some thoughtful then, whether it's a public policy response or a community organizing response. So this is very important work, laying the groundwork for shared knowledge.
Yeah. Anne-Marie, could you say a word about this kind of – we talk about inequality in the state. That I believe your research shows that inequality is actually rising. And it's not just inequality overall, but there's also inequality between the northern part of the state and the southern part of the state. So tell our listeners a little bit about where you see things, where you see things going.
Sure. Well, you know, income inequality specifically is measured by the Gini Index. So the U.S. Census Bureau publishes the Gini Index. And they found New Hampshire was one of nine states last year that saw an increase in income inequality. And if you look at the trend, actually that increase was evident in the year prior as well. So one of nine states where this is, you know, increasing at a higher rate. And so that's the gap between, you know, the people on the lower income end of the spectrum and the higher end of the spectrum. So we know that that's happening, measured by the Census Bureau's data. And we also know that, you know, more than one in five households in New Hampshire have incomes below $35,000 a year.
One in five, 20%.
One in five. Yes, that is 20%. Yes. Yeah.
So while the median income of the state is high,
yes,
that doesn't mean that everybody's doing well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, we have our recent – if you go on our website, the most recent publication is a fact sheet that has some county-level data, has the numbers for various counties and the median household incomes for those. So that's readily available. And it is very different depending where you are in the state. And, you know, cost of living may be lower in the North Country, but wages are lower in the North Country too. So if you really compare those two things together, you find that people are struggling everywhere.
Well, and I bet the cost of food is probably more expensive in the North Country than it is in the southern part of the state. And you might have to drive further to get to the supermarket.
Yeah, absolutely.
And drive further to get to the hospital or the doctor, or drive further to find a job, all those things.
So what's exacerbating the divide? Is it our tax policy? Is it the flight of young people? Is it a spike in housing costs for poor and working class and middle income, for renters, for example? What are considered the reasons why our ends of the spectrum are getting further apart?
Yeah, well, there are many factors, to be sure. It's a measure of income. So, you know, you could look at our wage floor. Our minimum wage is low. It's $7.25 an hour. You know, there are other states that also have that level. But New Hampshire has a fair number of higher income earners. So there is that interplay there.
Was that what drives it? I mean, is it a matter of in-migration of basically
of
rich
wealthy people?
Is that?
I don't I don't think I could really answer, right. You know, what is the thing that drives it? There are many, many factors that drive it.
I mean, I guess if we think, Maggie, that inequality is a problem in and of itself, mm-hmm. I mean, it's a different issue than the issue of poverty. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, inequality does tend to be associated with greater degrees of social conflict and other social ills, even sort of taking out the issue of poverty. Mm-hmm. So it's not healthy.
In and of itself.
In and of itself, in a country or a place that wants to be democratic, to tolerate high levels and growing levels of inequality.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something we need to be giving attention to. Mm-hmm. But if mm-hmm. we don't understand what is causing this inequality, mm-hmm. then it's hard to craft public policies that will take it back in the other direction.
Yeah, there's no single silver bullet. It's
good
many
reason
things,
to go yeah, to this New Hampshire Fiscal Policy Institute conference on Friday
Absolutely.
In Concord.
Yes. Oh. And you can still register.
Oh,
if you
good
jump
to know.
On our website tonight, you will still be able to get in. We still,
very
we still
good.
How many people typically or how many people do you expect to come to this?
We generally have about 150 mm-hmm. in the gathering, and it's a mix of state policy. Policymakers, local yeah. leaders, foundation,
activists,
funders, yes, activists, advocates, nonprofit staff, and community leaders, and you know, many members of the public who are just concerned about New Hampshire and they want to learn more. And you know, I just love hearing from folks who attend who say, you know, this is the event that really helps connect the dots. You know, oftentimes folks that work in health policy, they attend an event that focuses on health, and the education folks, you know, focus on education. Mm. And this brings it all together,
right.
You know, social determinants of health, right. Something we'll also touch on at the event, you know,
good.
And all of these things are related
That's right.
to your health.
And we're
your...
whole people, so we have, yeah. we have, you know, we need a healthy education system, we need a healthy healthcare mm-hmm. system, we need housing that is healthy and sustainable and all yeah. of that.
And affordable.
And affordable.
Yeah, yeah.
We are not siloed beings.
Yeah. And Marie, the Institute at this point is really a research institute as opposed to an advocacy group, but I know that you get over to the State House. So what are the issues that you find that you are bringing that are of greatest relevance to people at the State House right now?
Yeah, you know,
this is not a budget year.
Absolutely right. But it's always we're always thinking about the budget.
Yeah,
of course.
Yeah. There's always one coming up soon.
Oh, there is.
Yeah. So you know, we're a small organization, right? We have two full time policy analysts, and I will say this is the first time we've had two dedicated full time policy analysts. So it's really enabling us to do more work, and we've been focusing some of that extra energy on the economic issues concerning the lower income and vulnerable populations of the state, trying to make sure that you know that piece of the story comes out. You know, yes, the economy is doing well by some measures, but by many other measures, it's not for many other people. So we're spending a fair bit of time focusing on that. And we are focusing on research and putting out material that helps contribute to the advocacy of others. So, you know, we're here as a resource for everyone interested in improving public policy.
Mm.
So, you know, Phil does, he's often over at the State House, particularly on a budget year
yeah.
when we're tracking, you know, nobody likes to talk about the revenue, but we track the revenue. It's really important, you know,
yeah.
to kind of stay on top of those things. So that's an area that we focus on. Housing, of course, is something that we're following, and education funding is going to be a big conversation right now. You know, the investments in the last state budget were important, but they're one-time investments. So, you know, that's going to be something that there's a commission looking at it now.
Right, and I believe there's legislation right now to extend the reporting deadline on when they have to finish up their mm-hmm. work. So instead of
yeah.
getting it done really before the election, they are now asking to be able to continue a little bit after that. So we will keep an eye on that. And Dave Luno, I believe, chairs that commission, and he's been here in the studio before. So we'll, maybe mm-hmm. we'll try to get him in before the session ends to get a little update, see if we can look behind the curtain at what their research is
yeah,
showing
already. Yeah, what's coming through in the yeah. study. Well, and something that we talk about, Arnie, on and off, but haven't really been able to do a whole lot of sustained work on, is our sense that the way that we do revenue in New Hampshire is a driver of inequality and a driver of inadequacy in investments in our community. So I'm curious if you have commentary about our New Hampshire taxation as one of the driving factors for the increasing inequality that you see here.
Well, you know, the state has, you know, pushed a lot of its responsibilities and financial obligations over time onto local communities. That's increased the pressure on the local property taxpayers.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that quite certainly is related, I'm sure.
Yeah.
We haven't looked at that specifically, but as you look at that rising, it's evident in education, of course, where you have local communities who are, you know, struggling to provide their children with the same access to resources, and they simply can't, you know. And if you have a school that can't offer AP classes, those kids aren't able to compete on the same level as the students who do have those opportunities. So
that's right.
You know, that's a case.
Well, I've talked to people from I have a friend who's active in the teachers union in Manchester, and as they are still trying to negotiate a new contract, and one of their issues is they can't keep teachers in Manchester because the teachers get paid, can basically get a signing bonus of a substantial amount of money to leave Manchester and go somewhere else.
So within the state.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just moving next door, whatever, and so that you end up with less experienced teachers who maybe they come to a place like Manchester. They're probably great people. They're talented. They're bright. They're dedicated.
Yep.
And they teach in Manchester for a few years, and then they can get a better job somewhere else. They're going to leave.
Yeah. This is the story in Dover as well.
Is it? Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that you? Because you've got friends and neighbors who are teachers as well as who are students
and
there.
And we have wonderful teachers, but they do see the comparison of their wages with other school districts, and it's demoralizing. It's difficult for people who have families to raise or elder parents to care for or houses to pay for. So.
And then this comes back to the way in which the state still relies in a disproportionate way on local property taxes to pay for the cost of education in the communities that are relatively lower down the scale in terms of property values or property values per student, just don't have the ability to raise the money, or they end up having to have extremely high taxes in order to generate money to get less good schools in their communities.
Right. And all of this feeds a mindset of real scarcity when it comes to, you know, it's the idea that we cannot invest sufficiently in what we need and what we care about because there simply isn't enough. Well, we could tax in ways that there could be much closer to enough. But it's going to require some really important conversations and some shifts in some of our assumptions.
All right. So equitable access in housing, health, and education is one of the topics that will be looked at the New Hampshire Fiscal Policy Institute's conference on Friday. We'll also be looking at local economic conditions. Can you say a little bit more about the North-South divide and what, if anything, do you see as – I mean, it's – I guess we all understand that the economy of northern New Hampshire for generations has been based on resource extraction and on tourism. And that's different from a southern part of the state, which has a much more of a technology-based economy at this point. Is there anything that can be done about that?
Well, that's a very good question. You know, I mean, I think so what – you know, comes to mind, obviously, you know, the tourism industry, you know, a fair number of those jobs up there in the North Country related to the tourism industry, they, you know, the wages aren't as competitive as they are in the lower areas of the state, and they're not consistent either. So that's a particular challenge, I think, for many folks that live up that way. You know, also there's the healthcare system with the closure of for example, the maternity ward and some of the rural hospitals. So now you don't have access to, you know, for folks that are, you know, trying to have a family, you don't have those same resources. And so you can imagine that people are potentially moving, you know, closer to the other resources that they need.
Or so, living the consequences of lack of adequate access to that health care that they need.
Right,
Lack
of adequate access to healthy food. I mean, all of those things have become an issue in those communities. So,
yeah.
Well, say a little bit more then about how people get involved in this and what else people can learn from the New Hampshire Fiscal Policy Institute.
And maybe what they can find on your website, too.
Yeah. Yes. Well, thank you for that opportunity. So our website is at nhfpi.org. Everything that we publish, all of our presentations, papers, reports, they're all available on our website. So you can definitely check that out there. And on our website, there's also a nice little graphic for our conference. And if you click that button, you'll see the whole agenda for the conference. and the link to register if you're interested. It will still be open, I think, until tomorrow morning. We'll have to close registration.
Yeah.
We will have same-day registration
on Friday. Would that be possible, like at the poll,
There's
to show
the
your
ebb
ID?
And flow,
yeah, anyway,
right?
Right.
Yes. Register and cancel.
All right. Well, I noticed that on the agenda it says that it will wind up with closing remarks by Anne-Marie French. So
yes, I'm going to tie it all together for you, and I can't tell you now.
So both of us are away on Friday. We would otherwise be there with bells on. We'll find out what that will be.
Yeah. So anyway.
Yes. Yeah. Well, we will post all of the presentations. Will be posted on our website as well.
Good.
They'll be on that conference page and also on our presentation page. So we like to make everything that we do publicly accessible so that folks can. You won't have the context of the presenters, of course, but you will have the information. And we're always here for questions if
folks
want to learn more. And related to fiscal capacity, that conversation that we were having a moment ago, we published a report in August of 2018. It's called Measuring New Hampshire's Municipalities, Economic Disparities and Fiscal Capacities. Mm. And it really looks at that question that you just raised and really kind of showcases it. Looks at, you know, SNAP enrollment on the municipal level, Medicaid enrollment on the municipal level, you know, income and property wealth, and those sort of things. And, it, you know, the story becomes quite clear, you know, the challenges and the disparities between communities, really.
Yes.
And, you know, we refer to it as fiscal capacity. You know, does the community have it? And many just don't.
Yeah. I'm going to check that out. That could be useful for our advocacy, as
Absolutely.
A matter of
fact. All right. Anne-Marie French, New Hampshire Fiscal Policy Institute, nhfpi.org. All right. Good luck with your conference.
Yes. And thanks for making the time to be here and for all the good work that you do.
On State House Watch.
And thank you for the opportunity.
All right. Great.
You're
so, Maggie Fogarty, what do we want our listeners to know about else that's coming up?
Well, tomorrow, February 18th, is one of our twice-monthly interfaith prayer vigils for immigrant justice at the Norris Cotton Federal Building. We have some friends checking in with ICE that day.
What does that mean? I'm checking in. That sounds so benign.
Yeah. So it's about 2.3 million people throughout the country are in kind of a limbo arrangement with Immigration and Customs Enforcement where they are not detained, thankfully. They are not incarcerated. They have not been deported yet, thankfully. But they also have an unclear path forward with regard to their immigration status. So these folks have to show up in front of an ICE officer at a certain kind of frequency.
Yeah, whenever ICE tells them.
Whenever,
basically.
Right. It could be in the early months of the Trump administration. This was every month. Very disconcerting for people. Mm-hmm. It seems to have eased a bit to be more like every 6 months.
Yeah.
But it's not uniform. It depends on the person. And people know going into these appointments that they could be detained on the spot. They could be something could have shifted that they'd be processed for deportation. Mm-hmm. So it's an anxiety-producing appointment, quite disruptive to the family in terms of often time off of work, children out of school.
Right. We're there outside every time we know of people who have
to show
up
our support for them.
Appointments.
Yeah.
First and third Tuesdays of the month normally.
So
the
tomorrow.
New Hampshire Black Heritage Trail has been continuing to do their Eleanor Williams Hooker Tea Talks every Sunday afternoon. Usually they are in Portsmouth. This coming one is Culture and Race in the Public Sphere. We will be away next week.
That's right. We should
say legislature will not be in session next week, so State House Watch will take a break as well. But we'll be back after that. We want to thank you for listening to us and encourage you to go to WNHNFM.org. All right. Hit the donate button and listen to all the other shows. We are going down the road. Thanks for listening. Over.